This episode of TechPod is brought to you by SolarWinds IT Trends Report 2021, Building a Secure Future. Read how tech pros perceive their organization's risk management and mitigation readiness after a year of rapid transformation fueled by the pandemic. Visit it-trends.solarwinds.com.
William Hurley, or Whirly, as he is often called, is a philanthropist, entrepreneur, and open source advocate who's lived what many of us in the geek space would consider to be a charmed life. He managed to dodge college without getting disowned by his parents. He worked at Apple and IBM. He participated in the creation of such mythically named inventions as the Board of Awesomeness, the Helmet of Justice, the Board of Imagination, and has titles like Master Inventor. He rubs elbows with folks like Bob Metcalf and Will.i.am, and has gotten to hang out at places like CERN. Yes, CERN, that one. And he's known for his thoughts on and experience with quantum computing. Welcome to TechPod.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And we are so excited to have you here. And I want to start by acknowledging that everyone asks you to explain quantum computing, so we're not going to. In the interest of time, we're not going to waste our chance to talk with you by demanding you retread this topic, which you've already handled really well in other forums. So for those listening who want to hear Whirly do a bang-up job on describing quantum computing or how it works or why it matters or any of the other things that we mentioned in this podcast, we're going to have links in the show notes. So you can stop scribbling things down, put your hands back on the wheel, pay attention to the road. It's okay. You will be able to get those notes later. I want to start with some shameless self-promotion and give you a chance to tell us more about Whirly and StrangeWorks and anything else, where people can find you on the interwebs, all that stuff.
Yeah, well, so finding me is pretty easy. You just go to Whirly on anything, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, or whatever. And I get tons of requests. So the only thing I ask is if you send me something you hear you're interested in or you think we should work together, just know it could be months before you hear back from me, but you will hear back eventually. As far as shameless self-promotion and StrangeWorks, look, there's only one thing. We pimp it every time, and we'll pimp it here. We did write Quantum Computing for Babies, which is an excellent, excellent, explanation. Literally, anybody can understand that, right? Like, it's so
simple.
This is
amazing. I have a 15-week-old grandson. I'm getting it for him.
Then you don't have to get it for him. You shoot me a mail and I'll sign one for your grandson and send it to you. Not a problem. But that's the only thing I could possibly shamelessly self-promote.
Okay, perfect. I also want to talk about, obviously, quantum computing is a ferociously difficult concept to understand. And obviously, you've put it in the simplest of all possible terms. Did you always have a knack taking difficult technical concepts and boiling them down? Or is that something you had to work on and learn how to do?
No, I still don't. I think explaining difficult concepts is kind of like a wedding, like something borrowed, something stolen, whatever. I mean, thank goodness there's a great community of people that I've surrounded myself with who help with that a lot. Sometimes I can't explain it, right? And we all need mentors and people to bounce ideas off. Sometimes you're borrowing parts of explanations or taking an explanation you've heard and modifying it. So I wouldn't say that I have any special talent for it. I grew up with Carl Sagan, watching him every week. And of course, he was very good on explaining extremely complicated topics in lay terms. And I think I just kind of have always been exposed that way. But most importantly, I have two parents who are wonderful, but not technical, and a whole set of family and friends where I've often found throughout my career explaining everything from like email on up. So I think it's just experience at this point.
And I think that's relevant for a lot of the folks who listen to TechPod, because whether they're a storage admin or a network engineer or whatever, they find themselves in situations where they have to, because their job depends on it, explain a fairly challenging concept like, VPN or SDN or whatever. And I think it's a little comforting to know that people who effectively have done written a book about it or whatever, it's still a skill that has to be developed and grown in the same way that we develop our other skills. So I appreciate that perspective. As I mentioned in the intro, you have done some really fun, really visionary, impactful things. And the best place to start talking about the real stuff, the quantum stuff, is that experience and perspective. When we mentioned to Sudhakar, our CEO, that you're going to be a guest, he had a question for you. And in the interest of my continued job security, I figured I would put his question first. He wanted to know if you have any predictions on internet evolution, especially with regard to trends that companies like us should be particularly cognizant of.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I'm a big believer that the 1920s are going to look like the 2020s. From the crash to the Industrial Revolution, I just think it's going to be a quantum revolution. So quantum mechanics will find its way from the fifth Solvay conference in 1927, where Einstein and Schrodinger and everybody came up with all of these concepts, into not just computing, but into sensing, into networking, into every aspect of our lives. So if you look right now, things I think that, you know, he as a CEO should be looking at are people, the company, post-quantum cryptography, obviously all of the new networking technologies that are quantum-based and photonics-based, and especially quantum internet. I mean, there is zero doubt that we will build a quantum internet at some point in the next 20 or 30 years, okay? And it may be much faster than that, right? I'm throwing out a crazy timeline just so that I'm, you know, I have to be careful with those because people take them as predictions. It's not a prediction. That's just a, you know, it's probably going to be here. And when you think about a quantum internet, a whole new set of challenges that come out. There was a great research paper that said that if you had a quantum internet and you had three pulse devices and you set off three pulses at the same time on this infrastructure, then it would just like, phew, there's no more internet. It's gone. So the threats and the things to monitor and the things to watch are going to change with this technology, right? You know, potentially. And so that's super fascinating. And also it's going to make things a lot more secure, right? So, you know, there's some, with all new technology evolutions, there's a plus and there's a minus. So I think, you know, those are the things I'd be looking at. As a monitoring company, you know, I would be looking at everything across that networking stack. You know, that would be my advice, because that Cisco's already working on quantum related technologies. Juniper's working on quantum related technologies. BMC, CA, all these companies you make. And these are of course back things, right? They're not monitored. These are like, you know, Cisco's going to make a box and it's going to be like, this is your quantum internet box. But you're going to have to monitor that box. You're going to have to watch that box. You're going to have a way of, you know, everything from, and the uptimes will be different, right? As you get in these quantum technologies, things get a little weird.
Right. And that's exactly where I wanted to go, which is, you know, we again, don't want to ask you to explain quantum computing, but it doesn't mean that we don't have tons of questions about it. And given that SolarWinds is a modern company that has seen a lot of stuff over the 20 years, what does monitoring mean in a quantum internet or a quantum computing environment? Like, how do you know if something is healthy or it's not, or performing well or not? Like, what are the KPIs? What are the values that might matter in that kind of context?
Yeah, my joke is I write software for computers that don't exist. So I don't know what you're going to monitor there. And that's probably good. We probably should give a little bit of explanation on the quantum. But when you think about what it's like monitoring on the network side, it's going to, there will be new things, right? For example, you'll be using things like teleportation and encryption for, you know, and so there'll be all these new, you know, you may have to monitor the entanglement between two particles that you're now using to communicate, right? I mean, that could get insanely complex, but also a lot more of the same, right? So think about token rings and then Ethernets and, you know, advances in fiber or whatever. The more things change, the more they stay the same, but there's like new levels of knowledge, new areas that you might want to monitor. On the computing side, that gets ridiculously different. And just give the, you know, standard kind of very quick deal. You know, we just took the whole team to Puerto Rico. We went to Ron Barlito rum and got a challenge coin there. Okay. So if we take this coin and we think of this as a bit, this white side is heads, this blue side is tails. If I put it in my hand, okay, in that two-dimensional plane, it can either be a one or a zero. That's it, right? A qubit is more like a soccer ball. If it's pointing directly up, it's a one. If it points directly down, it's a zero. So when I flip that coin in the air, is it at that apex of that turn a one or a zero? And the answer is it's not in a position of both, which is one of the myths of quantum. It's not in a superposition, doesn't mean it's one and zero at the same time. It means it's in a probability of one and zero at the same time. We can measure that. When we monitor that, when we measure it, it collapses the state and we end up with a one or a zero. Right. So think about it, you know, think about it like Schrodinger's cat. Right. You know, famous thought experiment. Let's put a cat in a box and pump poison gas into it. And I'm like, what was that guy thinking? But, you know, whatever.
Right. He was not a cat person.
But I mean, I get him. It's a really dramatic. Apparently doesn't like cats. But the thing is a cat alive or dead? And the fact is that until you open the box and see, you do not know. Right. And so what we do is you take something like a salt atom, you blow it up, you pull an electron off or whatever, you take this atomic particle, you trap it with lasers, you freeze it down to almost absolute zero, you prevent it from moving around a lot. And then we can take that soccer ball I described, that block sphere, and we can rotate it on the X, Y, and Z, or H, and that's how we do calculations. It allows you to look at, like, if you think a classical computer is looking like n space, it'd be like n squared, right? So we can look at a much wider set of probabilities and collapse them down to an answer that's most likely right. You're not going to use these things for some of the common tasks that, you know, people think of computers. Right now, people are treating quantum computers the way IBM treated mainframes or and home computers back in the day, right? You remember they made famous statements, you know, it's probably not a need for more than 3 or 4 computers in the entire world.
Got it. Okay, so and this again dovetails where I wanted to go, which is, what do you think the most real impactful thing quantum computing can do today?
Not much. That's a reality. So right now, the experiments you're seeing are smaller for the most part. They're 7 qubits, 8 qubits, 10 qubits. Okay, now a qubit, it could equal a million or more bits, depending on how you do it. But these computers are used for something completely different. And why everybody listening should be excited about quantum and all of these technologies changing is this could be the biggest shift in computing in the entire history of computing. Okay, so it's not going to make the cat videos on the internet faster. It is going to allow us to find cures for diseases, new drug discovery, new material sciences to go to Mars, better financial things, fixing the environment, right? If Earth is quantum mechanical and nature is quantum mechanical, then why can't we work on environmental problems, things like that, by mapping it one-to-one using quantum mechanics? So it's going to change everything. And you know, I talked about my parents earlier not being, you know, super tech savvy. They're going to use quantum computing, and the way they'll use it is, I would predict, and I think this is not a very big prediction to make, that even your adaptive text and autocompletes will actually all be put into a quantum computer and a model where they'll get more and more accurate and et cetera, right? So it'll come in. But at the same time, you take something like Shor's algorithm, right, which is kind of one of the most famous algorithms people talk about. It only has 5 steps. So Shor's algorithm is what we would use to break an encryption key. Okay, so something we're all interested in, right? Step number one, it's, you know, is it an even or odd number? And is it the product of 2 coprimes? You know, pick a random number to use in our experiment. Only that 4th step is where the non-deterministic quantum magic happens. The 5th step is try it all again if it didn't work. I could write you an iPhone app or a shell script or something that could do the 4 of those 5 steps so incredibly fast. But that 4th step, that's where the magic happens. And to put that in time of context, because people, the biggest misconception is speed. Like I said, doesn't make cat videos faster. What it does do is the following. It does allow for us to do things that we just can't do today. So classic example would be traveling salesperson. We want to send everybody on this video to 14 cities. I pop it into my Mac. I put all the routes and all the variables. Takes it 1,600 seconds, 2,000 seconds to figure it all out. But if we go from 14 to 22, a difference of only 8, that same laptop takes 2,000 years. And if we add another 8 to that, it takes longer than the time of the known universe. So those are the kind of problems that quantum computing is focused on. And so programming them is different, how you're utilizing them is different, where they're at in their evolution. The thing about quantum computing, though, that differs from classical is that, one, they're partners. You're never going to have a quantum computer without a classical computer for like 100 years, if you ever do at all, okay? You need the classical computers to manage the cryogenics and to get the data over, and that, you know, it's a partnership, right? It's a partnership. But what these computers are going to do is open completely new areas. The way I like to think about it is, right now, we're in 1963, and a guy named Jack just came out and said, here's a thing called a microprocessor. And everybody's thinking about how with the spreadsheets, and that's kind of what we're doing quantum computing right now. We're like, ooh, can it break encryption? Can it this? I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about in 1963, when that announcement came out, nobody was thinking about the internet or autonomous vehicles or drones or AI or whatever. We're about to have all of that happen again, a giant reset with trillions of dollars of opportunity, absolute fantastic sci-fi technologies that are all going to happen as quantum computing comes into its own.
From a simplified way, what this reminds me of is the barrier that they hit trying to get modems to work over regular phone lines back in the day, that there was so much noise on the phone lines that they couldn't get the actual signal to go through until chaos math came on board. And when the chaos mathematicians came in and they said, no, you're looking at each individual, you know, signal, where if you take a step back and you look at it, you can filter out the noise. And it sounds like the same kind of thing, that we've got these incredibly complex problems that quantum physics will allow us to take that step back and view from a different perspective and allow us to get a grip on it from that way.
Well, you know, you mentioned the biggest Achilles heel in quantum computing is noise. Much like that modem example right now, creating a qubit is not hard. Adding another qubit is not hard. However, as we add a qubit, the noise in the system goes so much and the fidelity drops that the system becomes useless. So we're actually not only looking to solve problems of that kind of complexity, we also have them ourselves in trying to build the machines to solve those problems.
Right. You got to make the car drive before you can start to build the, you know, NASCAR or whatever. Okay, so it's no secret that tech itself is filled with a lot of buzzwords and vaporware. Quantum computing is probably one of those topics that suffers the most from mislabeling and misdefinition. So what does technologists, and especially like the pundit, you know, tech pundits, get consistently wrong about the realities of quantum computing? This is your chance to set the record straight.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So number one, the encryption thing, you read about that all the time. Look, security is kind of a joke, right? The way we've built security is we build a wall, you tear it down, we build a bigger wall, right? I mean, let's face it. Like the fact is, all security is based on time and resource. So we just try to make it super expensive and really hard, and then we hope you go hack somebody else. Okay, so that's going to come to an end because of quantum computing. And by the way, I think that's a good thing. So that's one thing they get wrong. Everybody's focused on like, it's going to, let's say that I could break your private key. We're not really talking about breaking keys. What we're really talking about is I get your public key and I mathematically derive your private key from it. And therefore I have all of your secrets, right? And so when that happens, it's going to happen once. It's not like I do all keys. I have to go do it individually. Still, that's kind of a big threat to privacy and everything, but they hype it up too much, right? So that if its effects on security, that's too much hyped up. Number two, superposition, right? It's not a state of one and zero at the same time. It's a probability of one of those, and they consistently oversimplify it to the extent that it doesn't make any sense. Number three, I mean, there's dozens, but I'll keep it to like my top four. number three is the timeline for quantum computing, right? People are like, oh, these things could still be 20, 30 years away. If you go to quantumcomputing.com today, which is where we have our free software for people, we have 9 IBM computers alone, just from IBM, available right now that you can program for free. We also have computers from maybe 6 or 7 other vendors. So they're real, they're here. They're just not as usable because we're still nascent, you know, kind of stage of the industry. But they're here. You can't say quantum computing is never going to exist. You and I can go use one right now live on this interview, right? It's there. It works. Now, does it do anything? That's number four, right? Number four is they all overhype what it can do. Right now, these machines can't do a lot. And the reason it can't do a lot is there's not a lot of experts in it. There's probably 200 people worldwide that matter in quantum computing. By the way, I wouldn't make that list if it were 1,000 people long. So we're talking about real, super talented, very actual genius people doing this work. And we need thousands, tens of thousands. We need a quantum workforce, right? So kind of that stage is often misrepresented. And I think, you know, the last thing, and this is gonna upset people, but hardware gets commoditized. I don't care. It's why Hyundai can make a car that's just like a BMW for 30 grand instead of 130 grand. And even though physicists in the space think they're gonna have one vertically integrated structure, and it's their software and their computer, and they own all of quantum computing. We know that's not true. We're not in the days of AMD versus Intel. We're in the days of mechanical gates versus vacuum tubes or some other thing. It's like we are so early. There's no need for that kind of thought or competitive vengeance as I've seen it. It's like there's a lot to do, and we need a lot more people involved in quantum computing to make it a reality. Good news on the good side out of all of that is, it's going to happen much faster than our entry into classical computing, because as these computers get into hundreds of qubits and they're already there, and then into thousands, we'll start being able to use these machines to solve some of the fundamental physics problems and noise problems and things with quantum computers. So I think when you look at it, the inflection point will be a much more dramatic jump that we've seen in the past with technologies. I remember when Barnes & Noble's CEO said, a website, Amazon, they don't even have a physical bookstore. So right now I am hearing companies that talk about quantum. They're like, quantum, that sounds like sci-fi. And it's like, well, sci-fi is coming and it's coming really fast. And the difference with quantum and classical computing is when Barnes & Noble didn't have a website and they decided to get one, there were thousands of people that could build a website and all of these things and, you know, Apache web servers are free and they could just go and do it. Right? With quantum, it takes years and years of training and knowledge. So if you're not starting that process now, and in 6 years, let alone God forbid, 3 or 2, which is where I think it'll hit, quantum hits and you go, you know, we were joking earlier before the call, the boss goes, give me some quantum stat, right? It's like, yeah, that's going to be a 3-year adventure just to find the people and get them trained. And then they're not going to have any subject matter expertise in whatever you're trying to do, right? And that's not to force, you know, forecast doom. I'm just saying, if there's one message for anyone listening to get out, it's that quantum is here. It is going to change things in ways you can't possibly imagine. And that change is going to happen at a breakneck speed. So if you're not already on it, you better go start getting on it today, because I started on looking at the space 7 years ago. I've been working in it for 4. I still don't know shit about quantum computing. Okay. So I'm in one of the, what was arguably definitely in the top 10 of companies in the space, and probably in the top 2 or 3 software wise. And I'm telling you flat out, I have volumes. Like, imagine 4 or 5 sets of Encyclopedia Britannica on physics. And I haven't even cracked the first page open on the first book. It's so much more complicated than people think. And it's happening. So you got to get on that train or it's going to leave you behind or God forbid, run over you.
Right. Yeah. And that absolutely is something we talked about earlier. And you hit on that on the other end of the punditry and the vaporware and things like that, you have regular boots on the ground, IT professionals who that executive comes in and says, Jimmy, buy me a box of quantum and I want to pour it all over everything. Like, they have no idea what they're talking about. And I think that it would be helpful for the TechPod audience to understand a little bit about how they're supposed to respond to that. On the one hand, it requires a huge amount of investment, a huge amount of skill and knowledge. And on the other, it's not really doing anything for us there, but again, executives are asking, demanding that we somehow inject quantum into it. So what would the regular IT practitioner say?
Yeah, I have this conversation 1,000 times a day, right? So I can make it very simple for everybody listening. Here's what you say. You say in a very nice way, you have no idea what you're talking about, but I'm on it. Here's what you do. You go free resources like the ones we have at quantumcomputing.com, the ones that are in all the open source quantum stuff on GitHub, whatever. And you go start playing around with that and you explain to your boss, you put a nice presentation and you explain to it. So just so you know, the person programming this machine at IBM right now has 1, sometimes 2 PhDs. My chief scientist at StrangeWorks has worked in quantum computing for over 20 years. Okay. And he doesn't necessarily know everything, right? None of us do. So you say, look, it's not like we're deploying a new network node or whatever. We have to have people that have the knowledge here. So you either have to go hire some physics PhDs or start training us or whatever. That's the first thing to use quantum computing on is your company, is to build your own quantum workforce. Who's going to be your subject matter expert versus your algorithm person versus the person that manages a machine or interfaces with the hardware companies? What about the monitoring? You know, obviously that's a topic on this past. That's going to be unbelievably, undeniably important that you start at the basics. There is no like look, we host all the simulators from everybody: Google, IBM, Blue Cat. Like, you can't name one that's not there on quantumcomputing.com for free. So you don't need to go install anything. You don't need to go do it. And that's not a pitch to quantumcomputing.com. The reason we built that is because we got so many questions. So, like, you know what? When you go on there and you look at the code, you fork some and you start playing with it, all of a sudden your boss goes, whoa, wait a second, what is all of that? Like, that's crazy, right? So then it really helps when, you know, this isn't something you go to GitHub and download an open source package and deploy it. You can go to GitHub and get any one of a number of open source simulators or things like that and do that. But what that does for you is that just, like, now you have a great example. We have had, I would say, millions. It's over the last 4 years, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, definitely over a million, right? People have come to the website. Of those, there's action that go, I'm signing up. I think I can do this. Of those, 99% fork an experiment, run it, get a result, go, I have no idea what that means, and they're gone and they never come back, right? That's the reality of quantum. And by the way, other people who might talk to you about quantum, Microsoft, AWS, whatever, they're going to say, oh, no, there's plenty of people. We have the largest Stack Overflow community. We have participating communities around the world. We have so much data on the space. There's not a use for these machines now. And so it sounds like I'm talking out both sides of my mouth because I'm saying there's nothing useful with them. You should go learn how to use them immediately. But the fact is, it's kind of Wayne Gretzky, right? You got to play to where the puck is going. And the puck is going to, and it's going there literally potentially faster than the speed of light. And therefore, you have to start doing that training and that learning and stuff now. It is just not a situation where you're going to have a developer who just picks up quantum computing. Trust me, that was in my original business plan when I started StrangeWorks. I've talked to tens of thousands of developers over the last 4 years. And, you know, maybe I've helped bring 100 into quantum, right? I mean, that's the reality. Like, think about it this way. In the early days of computing, you had to be an electrical engineer to program a computer because you had to understand the flow of electricity between the gates. In the early days of quantum computing, you pretty much have to be a quantum physicist so you can understand, like, how are you going to debug something with teleportation? Right? You're going to call an API call to it, and you're like, boom, I'm easy, and it breaks. And then what do? You got to know something about teleportation, right? Or what if you're working in the hardware side or you're monitoring these qubits? I mean, do you know how many things interfere with them? Gamma rays, the spin of the earth, the wind, vibrations. Like, you're literally doing things at such a small scale. There's a lot of gotchas in there. And so that's why I'm saying, you know, it's definitely coming, but it's not something you just go out and say, I'm doing quantum computing, which is ironic. Everybody thinks that's what I did. And they don't understand. Like, I did look at it for a couple of years before I got into it. And then with a lot of trepidation, got into it. And now I regret it.
Right. And I think that the point that you made a little bit earlier about, you know, to tell your boss, we need to start building an awareness, not a plan, but an awareness. We need to figure out, right, out who has a natural predilection to algorithms, who has a natural predilection to really far out science, who just like to learn lots of things, who can say, this is where we're at.
Yeah. What developers did really good in physics in school, right? Like, but you got to build it. You got to make an awareness, use the awareness to build a team. Then you train the team. Then you can start looking towards, hey, here's algorithms we could use, or here's this, or here's that. And you do not need hardware right now. We sell hardware to our customer. There's people that do need it. You know, if you're at Pfizer or Moderna or J&J or somebody, you need hardware access. 99% of everybody else can do so much with simulators, and it will be such a big leap just to get you to try to write something and test it and prove it out in a simulator. It's like, trust me, it's more than enough. Using the hardware is a bridge too far. But like I said, go to quantumcomputing.com, sign up and use the IBM machines today for free. And there's even examples of code. And then I think what you'll do is you'll go, oh yeah, that is it's a little more complicated.
that's quite a thing. Wow. Okay. All right. I want to pivot away from quantum for a little bit. And the first thing I want to ask you about is Austin, Texas. So for those who don't know, you are based in Austin, and it's seen a lot of explosive growth in tech with a lot of major companies moving their HQ there, having offices and stuff. Do you think, in your humble opinion as a non-real estate developer, is Texas the next Silicon Valley? Do you have any thoughts on the changes? Just, you know, from one Austin company to another, what are your thoughts about all of it?
So look, I hope we're not the next Silicon Valley. I've never been a fan. I love the weather. There's so many great things. I'm not crapping on Silicon Valley for the people listening that are from there. All my friends are there, right? I just think Austin has always had this kind of laid back, a little bit more hippie tech, right? It's a little bit more like, you know, at StrangeWorks, our release schedule is, when we're done with the software, we'll let you know, we'll release it, right? We're not like trying to cram things into scrum meetings or and I hope we don't lose that kind of example. For me, the issue is simple. We can't let the housing costs go too high and the office rents go too high and all the things entrepreneurs and tech companies need to get started and survive, right? Because what happened is you saw that happen in San Francisco, and you saw San Francisco spread out into the valley. And already you have Houston doing amazing things with tech and the incubators, from the Canon to, you know, the Use Innovator Map, all of that. You have San Antonio doing stuff. Dallas was already there. So we look a lot like a model for like a new valley. But what the problem with the valley was is that everybody looked to it as the sole place to get innovation from, when there are people and Bangalore and you know, Croatia and, you know, Europe, there's innovation stuff everywhere. And so I hope that we can take advantage of all the people moving here and that talent and the companies. Obviously, you know, reporters call me all the time about, you know, where's Apple's thing? That one bugs me, because I started my career, as you said in the beginning, at Apple in 1993 at their one of their six offices at the time here. I'm like, no, they're just building a big campus. There's thousands of Apple employees, Austin. But, you know, obviously, you've got the Tesla Gigafactory out here by the airport that, you know, is going up. If you haven't watched those videos, it's amazing. That thing is incredibly huge. You've got all of these companies moving to town, just whole companies, healthcare companies, you know, physics companies, networking companies. So I think, you know, my worry is that we don't manage the basic cost of living so that everybody can have an playing field in an entrepreneurial fashion. Because I don't think San Francisco is even. I know people say it is, and you can go and meet all these people, but I also know that there's a class system there, right? There's like the new tech guy to San Francisco or gal, and then there's the, you know, you've been there and now you got the thing. And then I literally, when raising money for StrangeWorks, had a venture capitalist suggest that maybe what I needed to do, because you didn't know how technical I was, is go work at Google for a couple of years and, you know, kind of get the chops. And after, and I was like, I'm not trying to be ego or anything. I was like, I thought I was being pranked. I was like looking at everybody in a meeting going like, is he seriously telling me I should go apply for a job at Google? Cause I'm never doing that. Like, you know? And so I think, you know, cost and keeping it Austin and friendly, and I'm trying to do my part. So at StrangeWorks, we help any entrepreneurs, anybody who wants to get into quantum, you can be competitive. We'll help you come by. We'll talk about it. We'll show you software and teach you, and you can go start something to compete with us. And the caveat is, the reason we're comfortable doing that is like, there should be no competition in quantum right now. We have a lot of work to do. There's not billions of dollars in quantum revenue sitting there waiting to be had.
We know you can't listen to our podcast all day, so out of respect for your time, we've broken this conversation up into two parts. We hope you'll join Whirly and me for the next episode of SolarWinds Tech Pod, and we'll continue our discussion. And of course, we know there's a plethora of podcasts out there to choose from, so we appreciate you devoting part of your day to listen to ours. If you like this episode, please consider following, rating, and even reviewing our show. I'm Leon Adato for SolarWinds Tech Pod. Until next time, thanks for listening.